WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The 2024 election will be, well, about a lot of things, not least our democracy. But it seems to me that the subject with the most substance in terms of policy, and also the most peril for the Democrats, is immigration. And it was very much in the news this week. Politicians on the right have sometimes distorted the situation at the border for sheer political gain. But the numbers of people seeking asylum now are tremendous. President Biden is saying that he would shut down the border if Congress passes a bipartisan bill giving him that authority. House Republicans aren't likely to pass the bill, and President Biden knows it. But this is a really dramatic change in tone.
If that bill were the law today, I'd shut down the border right now and fix it quickly.
For more than a decade, our staff writer, Jonathan Blitzer, has been covering immigration, talking to enforcement officers at the border, White House officials, and of course, to the people who risk it all, risking their lives very often to cross the border. All of that has gone into John's new book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here. I spoke with Jonathan Blitzer last week. John, if I turn on Fox, the first thing I see, and the second and the third, is the Chyron crisis at the border. What is the crisis at the border, and how long has it been going on, and how did it start?
The crisis at the border is an endless crisis that gets rolled out every election year and is a reliable winner for Republicans because Democrats are seen as being weak on the border. The sad fact for Democrats is there really is a problem at the border. The system cannot handle the sheer volume of people who are showing up at the border. What is that a function of? In large part, it's a function of what's happening in the world. Not that there's any room for this kind of nuance or context in the political debate happening in Washington around this.
Yeah, but give us the nuance and give us the context.
I mean, you know, what you're seeing in the hemisphere is an unprecedented period of mass migration and displacement, and it is the result of a number of factors. COVID plays a big role. Economies have collapsed. There have been, you know, repressive governments in Venezuela, for instance. Kind of all of these different regional conflicts, climate change, you know, people who had left their countries and relocated elsewhere in the region only to find those economies collapsing as a result of COVID. The population of people who are showing up at the border is changing, which is worrisome for any administration because it has included people from certain countries where historically the U.S. can't deport them. And so, you know, we're talking
for example,
Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. That has recently changed as a result of high-level diplomatic intervention. But the point is the U.S. system, immigration system at the border and beyond, can't easily deal with the kinds of people. I mean, you're seeing right now, you know, arrivals on the order of 12,000 people a day. These numbers are astronomical. There aren't places to hold all of them. And so for as long as there aren't the resources to contain and process people as they arrive, large shares of those people are going to be released into the interior of the country. The Democrats are scared of talking about this.
Why?
I think they see a lose-lose with their constituencies. You have the progressive left that's going to oppose any kind of increased enforcement or harshness at the border, which from an operational standpoint really is necessary in some form or another. So you're kind of lose-lose on that side of the ledger.
Well, let's slow down then. If the progressive left was represented at this table, what would the argument be for not having more restriction at the border?
They would say that asylum is worth saving. It's salvageable. There just isn't the political will inside the administration to take the measures necessary to handle all of these newcomers and give them a chance to lodge their asylum claims. The inconvenient fact in that is that the vast majority of people who are showing up at the border would not win their asylum cases.
Why not?
The nature of asylum law is such that it specifies a very specific set of forms of persecution someone has to be suffering from in order to qualify for relief at the border, for protection. And so the people who are showing up now are definitely fleeing for their lives in some form or another. It might be extreme poverty. It might be a collapsing government. It might be that their house was wiped out in a hurricane. But those technically aren't forms of persecution as the law has defined that term. And so if you want to find some way of treating them humanely, you need to think more deeply about systemic reform. And that leads to the obvious problem of Washington and Congress, and there's just no movement there.
Pramila Jayapal, who's the head of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, said the big problem in immigration, from her point of view, is the fact that you can't pass anything in Congress because of the filibuster.
I think it's probably for reasons even beyond the filibuster. The issue is so toxic that any effort to reform the system, which is sorely needed, is dead on arrival. I think one thing the Biden administration has done is they've said, okay, look, there's the only way to handle the flow isn't to try just to deter people at the U.S. border. By the time they reach the border, it's too late. Now, the administration is going to want to be more orderly and enforcement-minded at the border in certain ways to try to send a message. But their thinking is we have to create other pathways, other legal pathways for people to come to the U.S. that doesn't involve their setting out and then arriving at the border and overwhelming our resources.
And the Trump solution to this is build a wall.
There were sort of two Trump solutions to this. You know, it has to be said that after probably the ugliest moment in recent American history with the family separation crisis, that was a classic Trump policy. That
in the
was
beginning 2018. Toward the beginning of the Trump administration or midway through.
Midway through. That was basically the government doing the harshest thing it could do to families at the border to try to scare other people out of coming to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, within 1 year, the numbers of people showing up at the southern border exploded, which just illustrates the fact that people who are fleeing for their lives, people who are in states of major desperation, are going to think first that they have to get to safety and only secondarily about what the exact border policies are going to be at any given moment. So Trump was struggling with this issue as late as 2019. The two things that he did that were distinct from what the Biden administration has done, particularly at the border, one was a policy called Remain in Mexico, where he basically shunted asylum seekers into northern Mexico and said, for as long as the system delays in processing your asylum applications, you have to stay here. The second thing that he did, and this was the result of the pandemic, was he basically ended asylum, invoking public health authority, saying it's just not safe to have people crossing the border. So the Biden administration has been in a bind with both of those things. First of all, Biden himself campaigned really strongly against the Remain in Mexico policy when he was campaigning for president the first time. And it was a very appealing message. He said, look, we have an asylum system for a reason. You can't just outsource asylum to another country. So to people who work operations inside the Biden administration at the start of his term, that policy valve wasn't available to them. You had then Title 42, this other measure, this public health measure, which the administration clung to for as long as it possibly could, because it basically allowed the government to expel people at the border without giving them asylum. The problem with that was they came to rely on that expulsion authority and never really had the wherewithal to begin to build back up the system that Trump wound down. And so now you have a global moment of mass migration converging on the border at a time when resources are down, Congress is refusing to give the president the money that he needs for basic operations. It's a perfect storm.
I'm talking today with Jonathan Blitzer. He reports for The New Yorker on politics and immigration, and his new book is called Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here. We'll continue in a minute. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm talking today with Jonathan Blitzer, who covers immigration and politics for The New Yorker. John's just published a terrific new book called Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, which to my mind is a definitive contemporary history of the immigration problem. We'll continue our conversation. It seems that Congress is on the verge of passing a bipartisan immigration bill, which would include money for Ukraine and Israel. Is that your understanding of where we are now?
We keep hearing that one of these days we're going to see the actual text of this bill.
Right.
And there's one delay after another. At a certain point, the president himself got out ahead of the negotiators to reassure everyone that one of the provisions in this putative bill would allow him to shut down the border and that he intended to do exactly that if the bill actually made it to his desk. But the bill itself hasn't materialized.
What does it mean for Joe Biden to close the border in practical terms?
It's an incredibly striking thing to see that he's even saying such a thing. Again, in 2020, I think a big part of his appeal in the campaign trail was that he stood in opposition to the inhumanity of Trump on this very issue. And that was one of the main planks in his immigration platform was we will resurrect asylum and we will kind of restore this fundamental American ethos.
You think of it as a desperate act on Biden's part because of his poll standings vis-a-vis Donald Trump?
I see it as a reflection of two things. The first is that this idea of shutting down the border, which did have a kind of concrete manifestation in the form of this technical public health maneuver that the Trump administration put into place that allowed the government to suspend asylum and just expel anyone who showed up at the border at the start of COVID, that has gotten normalized over the years. Mm-hmm. The Biden administration eventually ended that particular policy, but it took the Biden administration a fairly long time to do it. And as a result, you started to see even some moderate Democrats entertaining the idea that it wasn't so crazy every once in a while to stop processing people for asylum at the border. So you see, first of all, the normalization of that idea. I think Biden, in a concrete sense, and this is the second point, yes, I think he feels real political pressure here to show that he takes this seriously and that he wants to be tough. And I think his expectation is that Republicans aren't really serious about negotiating in any sense and that maybe he can call their bluff and the public will see him calling their bluff and that that's a way he can flip the script on Republicans. Last week, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said to members of his conference in the Senate, listen, you know, we may have to pause on this Senate negotiation because our presumptive nominee is running for president on the immigration issue, and we don't want to give President Biden a victory. We want to allow Trump to run successfully on this issue.
So let me get this straight. There's gambling in Casablanca. There's cynicism in Washington. So the issue that Donald Trump seems to care about most, and certainly his appeal is most intense on, in terms of policy, immigration, is something that he wants to forestall. He wants to forestall this bill simply because of his electoral chances, just to be clear.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the ironies of this is the bill itself, the language that we've at least seen from conversations so far around this bill, wouldn't really, in a profound way, change the dynamics at the border.
What would it do?
It would essentially make it harder for people to pass that initial asylum screening. That's a significant thing. That's a historic change to the asylum system. There's no question. And there are other provisions that we're hearing about that would basically say if a certain number of migrants arrive at the border on a given day, the president will have the authority to, quote unquote, shut the border down. Now, what that means is unclear. What's hung up in these negotiations, of course, is a request, a funding request from the president that would allow them to take some of the pressure off at the border right now. That's what's getting held up.
You write that Stephen Miller's ultimate ambition was to end the asylum system completely, entirely. What can we expect in a second Donald Trump term where immigration is concerned?
It's almost hard to imagine they're going farther than they already had. I mean, they basically sabotaged the immigration system as we knew it in the previous term. What's so scary to me about the prospect of a second Trump term is that all of the radical things they did in the first Trump term, the Muslim ban, trying to end DACA for legal protection for dreamers, separating families and the like, all of that is now just sort of part of the arsenal that a government can use. And that is less shocking the second time around. They've claimed that they're going to be doing things like setting up internment camps and ramping up deportation. I actually think one of the darker ironies of the Trump years was that for all of their promises of mass deportations, the chaos and disorder of how they actually enforced that agenda led to kind of more of the same rather than a huge explosion in deportation. You can rest assured that they have learned from their mistakes and that they're going to do everything they can to correct anything that didn't go well in the first term.
This is a huge part of Donald Trump's appeal to the American voter. Why is it appealing and to whom?
You know, I think that there's always been an assumption that the case for immigration makes itself, that kind of the moral high ground makes sense to everyone, that we should be welcoming, that, you know, people who show up in need obviously should seek protection.
It's the nature of the country. It's good for the workforce and on and on.
Exactly. I don't think defenders of immigration have squared the high ideals with some of the practical realities. And sadly, you know, the border, which is a tiny sliver of what the immigration system is as a whole, ends up dominating the entire conversation.
Right. Not everybody comes through the southern border. They often come through airports, right?
Exactly. And there's a whole legal immigration system that, you know, you'd want to work in some sort of basic way. And in fact, the idea that the immigration system as a whole has been starved of any kind of solutions for decades. I mean, the last time Congress meaningfully passed legislation on immigration was 1990. I mean, the world has changed 1,000 times over since then.
Right.
And so the Trumpian appeal is to point to disorder at the border and say, all of the problems in your life aren't going addressed. And look what we're doing for these newcomers who've earned nothing and who are now, you know, benefiting from American largesse. And that, I have to say, if in a kind of cynical way, that makes sense to voters who are frustrated and who are confused and who are scared. I think that the Biden administration should be pointing to things like, you know, 8 million job vacancies across the country that need to be filled, and they can be filled with workers, with foreign workers. You know, you could have people coming from a foreign country on temporary work visas, and you wouldn't have any of this drama at the border. You'd have people coming in an orderly way. It would be satisfying very specific needs in a bunch of states, including red states. And it would also incentivize people to come, work, and then return home. And it would create a circular migration pattern rather than this buildup at the border.
Does Trump's rhetoric and demagoguery depend completely on mythology and fear, or is there any truth in it? For example, one of the things that he bangs away at is that immigration brings more criminals and crime.
I mean, this is an easy one because this is a demonstrable falsehood. You know, the Republican line on this and the Trump line specifically has always been to trot out the families of victims of crime perpetrated by immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, these are a tiny, tiny sliver of a minority of cases. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the whole, all of the data supports this. Any and all evidence that you could canvass makes very clear that immigrants commit crime at much lower rates than American citizens. Obviously, Trump and his allies see a benefit to continuing to stay on that same script. But what's remarkable, actually, is how nearly identical the script is on immigration now as it was in 2016. It's the same routine. I mean, I was recently at one of these hearings in Congress, mm-hmm. For the impeachment of the Secretary of Homeland Security, Mayorkas, and it was the same scheme that Trump did on the campaign trail in 2016. They brought family members of people who had died at the hands of some immigrant, and they said, you know, in this case, the Secretary of Homeland Security is to blame. I mean, this was literally a page out of the Trump campaign book.
I do want to ask this. Would all this be happening if Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, had not had the, what would we call it, the political imagination to send groups of migrants to cities like New York?
You know,
how much did he spark this?
Abbott changed the conversation on the border for Democrats in a profound way. You know, now you see among mainstream Democrats a willingness to take more dramatic action at the border than we've really ever seen. But what Abbott has done is he has really supercharged the politics. And, you know, it didn't come out of nowhere, it should be said. In 2021, he started a massive statewide enforcement campaign that I think ran pretty afoul of federal law called Operation Lone Star.
And what was that? What was Operation Lone Star?
It was basically to deputize state law enforcement officials to make immigration arrests and to use money, personnel to, you know, line people up along the border and go after migrants, you know, engage in racial profiling, really quite dramatic stuff. And in the early days of the Biden administration, when it was clear that Abbott was ramping up this effort, I think there was a certain reticence on the part of the Biden administration to bring the fight to Abbott, say, by suing him for these policies.
Yeah.
And over time, you've watched as Abbott has kind of ramped up the pressure bit by bit. And so, you know, a year later, that was 2021, in the spring of 2022 is when he begins the busing. Now you have something like 80,000 people he's bused to Democratic cities.
Right now, Republicans in Congress are pushing to impeach Alejandro Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security, which is quite extraordinary. What role will that play in this entire drama about immigration and the political crisis in Washington?
You know, I'm covering this story right now, and you have this incredible split screen where certain Senate Republicans are calling Mayorkas to get advice and input on technical solutions at the border as they're having these negotiations about a possible bill. And simultaneously, their counterparts in the House are charging ahead with this impeachment effort. This impeachment effort is purely political. It's a chance for them.
What are the alleged charges? What are the allegations here? What are the charges that they're proposed to bring against Mayorkas?
The literal charges are dereliction of duty. And they're claiming that the secretary is deliberately refusing to enforce the law at the southern border as a way of flooding the country with immigrants, which is an outlandish notion. I mean, the idea that you could certainly criticize the Biden administration for not, you know, being more orderly in its pursuit of particular policies at the border and so on. It's quite another thing to say there's sort of deliberate malice here and deliberate intent to bring chaos to the border and disorder onto the country. I mean, it's really out there.
How far will this impeachment attempt go, and what effect will it have?
You know, it's interesting. They're going to come close in the House. I mean, they've got this razor-thin majority. But interestingly, this idea has come up since the start of the Biden administration. Congressional Republicans have wanted to impeach someone. Mayorkas was always a good bet for them because there was so much division among Republicans, and immigration was the one issue that kind of united moderate Republicans and right-wing Republicans.
Has a cabinet member ever been impeached?
The last time was in the 1870s. So this is, we're going deep into history here. I mean,
it's a very historically minded Congress.
Yes. This is a teachable moment for the country.
Now, it occurs to one to ask the question, how many immigrants can the United States feasibly handle? Matt Iglesias wrote a book in 2020 called 1 Billion Americans. And he argued that significantly increasing the population was one of the potential keys to economic growth in this country. And at the same time, obviously, poses societal challenges. Do you think significantly increasing the population is good for the country overall?
I think it definitely is. I couldn't quantify it. I couldn't quantify kind of like what the upper limit might look like. But I don't think that there's any question that for economic reasons alone, more people coming legally, working legally, would be a boon to everyone. And I don't think any economists really question that at this point. I think it's a kind of widely shared view that managed immigration is a net benefit to the country.
We're in a building that overlooks, if you go high up enough into the building, that you can see very distinctly in the harbor, the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, and other symbols of American welcome to immigrants. My grandparents landed in Ellis Island and Castle Garden and all the rest. Maybe that was the same with you. And all that we've been talking about, how does that square with the American self-image, self-regard about its generosity as well as its practicality?
I mean, I think it's gotten harder and harder, frankly, to continue to hold up that ethos as a definitional one to American society. I don't think it's completely lost. It's ironic given how we're talking about the Biden White House's sort of political lethargy in dealing with immigration, because I do think that one of the energizing forces in his campaign in 2020 was to make a strong moral case for inclusion. That gets lost in the political parsing of immigration in this country. You know, Trump's, you know, draconian, inhumane political bent on all of this stuff was a liability for him. That did not help him in the 2020 election, but that was because there was a strong, clear message in opposition to that. What I wish there was more of in the political conversation was a yoking of ideals that I think probably a majority of Americans believe in some form or another with the pragmatic appeal, which actually dovetails with the moral argument.
What do you mean?
Well, one of the most striking things for me reporting on these issues is that I often find government officials who work for agencies that tend to be notorious, agencies like ICE or Customs and Border Protection, these sort of fearsome-sounding agencies where we all assume that, you know, it's a kind of rough bunch who work there. A lot of them, quite honestly, make pretty progressive-sounding arguments when it comes to specific questions. What should we do at the border? How should we manage the flow of all these people who are arriving? You hear very practical, unsentimental arguments from them about, all right, listen, the parole system is really our best bet right now because we can't detain everyone. That doesn't make sense. What I find is when I have those conversations with them, sure, we get in the weeds and we're talking about operations, but those conversations actually square with the more idealistic arguments that, you know, we might feel, but that we kind of assume somehow are an inconvenience to the actual practical administration of the immigration system. You know, if you were to talk to a practitioner, I'm not talking about a kind of professor or an immigration advocate. I'm talking about someone who works for one of these government agencies and has deep experience at the border processing people. You'll hear them say, oh, here we go, another set of apparently harsh enforcement measures that will not really do much. Smuggling networks might respond in a matter of weeks. We might see a dip for a month. And in 2 months, we're going to have the same problem as before. And now what do we have? We've inherited a system that's even a little bit more harsher, but doesn't address any of the real problems we're seeing.
That tells you what? That what is the thing that is absolutely needed at the border in terms of practicality and policy? Stripping away all the rhetoric, stripping away all the ill will and worse, what's absolutely needed?
What's absolutely needed, and it scares me to say it aloud because it's so hard to imagine in our political landscape. What's needed is a massive sort of whole of government, this is often said in Washington, a whole of government approach to the issue, not just the Department of Homeland Security, you know, getting more border agents to man ports of entry. You need the State Department involved. You need the Defense Department involved. You need
to do what?
To open up processing centers in the region, all over Latin America.
So this is a question of a bureaucracy being overwhelmed above all.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the real problem is we are dealing with the arrival of people too late in the process. People are uprooted at rates that we've not seen in generations. That's a function of the world. The U.S. alone can't control all of that, other things they can do to mitigate it. But when people are moving at that rate, to just tune in at the border, I mean, there are concrete things that would help at the border. And right now, Congress is blocking them. Funding, more immigration judges, streamlining the asylum process, more border agents, the whole thing. That's fiddling around the margins. It would help, but that wouldn't deal kind of with the overall problem. The overall problem is you have a number of people that no governmental system can process doing all of that processing in the worst possible place, right at the border. If there are ways of beginning that process, of beginning to handle these people, to handle their claims, to understand who's coming why and what they need and what they want, to do that a little farther from the border, that would require, I mean, you're hearing as I'm describing this, this is the work of years. This is the work of, you know, multiple governments. This is something that, you know, no single administration can do overnight. And when you really think about it, it seems like an insoluble problem because the politics just stand in the way. And there needs to be some way of keeping the politics at bay while the actual solutions are set in motion.
Jonathan Blitzer, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his new book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, goes deep into the history of our immigration system and into the lives of migrants making this extraordinary and often dangerous journey. I'd recommend it to anybody who wants to understand this current and complicated issue and the way it shapes our politics. Now, with all due respect to Beyoncé and Taylor Swift, the year in music in the youth division belonged to 20-year-old Olivia Rodrigo.
I hate to give the satisfaction asking how you're doing now. How's the castle built of people you pretend to care about?
At Sunday's Grammy Awards, she's up for Album of the Year, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Rock Song. In fact, there's a lot more, but I'm running out of breath. I spoke with Olivia Rodrigo in the fall when her album Guts had just come out,
and we talked about her breakout song Driver's License and her influences and much more.
Yeah, I mean, I give my parents a lot of credit for my music taste. My parents love 90s alternative rock. I grew up listening to, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins and Hole and the White Stripes. And also, from a very early age, I kind of fell in love with a lot of female singer-songwriters, and I kind of realized that that was, you know, the kind of lineage that I wanted to follow. Mm. I remember going to the thrift store with my mom when I was probably 13 years old and getting Tapestry by Carole King for the first time and just playing it to death.
I feel the earth move under my feet.
I'd play it over and over and over and get all these Pat Benatar records and play them over and over and over, and Joni Mitchell, and I don't know, I just remember something clicking in my head when I was really young and being like, wow, those are the girls that I want to emulate, you know?
Looking back, what was the first song that you wrote that you thought, now this is something, this isn't just kidding around, this could bring me somewhere?
I mean, I wrote many songs when I was, you know, just putzing around in my living room when I was young. But I actually remember writing Driver's License. I remember that exact feeling.
Which became a huge hit.
Which, yeah, I mean, I owe so much to that song. It, you know, skyrocketed my career in ways completely unimaginable to me at the time. But I just remember writing that and feeling like I really expressed something and feeling like I felt like there was so much of myself in that song. And I remember feeling properly represented, and that's just a really beautiful feeling. I remember coming into the studio to show my producer the song and saying to him, like, verbatim, I think I just wrote my favorite song that I've ever written. And he was like, okay, sit down and play it.
Well, tell me about the experience of writing. How did it work? Because what one of the things that I love about it is it begins so directly. It sets the age, it sets the mood, it sets the where you are right with the first line.
Yeah.
How did this happen?
It's very specific. Yeah. I mean, I quite literally got my driver's license a few days before I wrote the song, and I was, you know, loving my newfound freedom. So I was driving around in my neighborhood and listening to sad songs and crying and thinking about this relationship. And I just sat down at the piano, and I'm a very emotional girl, as I am now. And I just cried at the piano and I wrote that song. And
what made you feel that sad in the car when you just had your license? I'm a Jersey kid. You're a California kid. Something about driving, I don't know what it is. It unleashes something.
It really does. You know, I thought about this a lot when I first got my driver's license. I think driving is one of the only times you're, like, truly alone, especially as a teenager.
Yeah.
When you're living at home with your parents. But I love it to this day. You know, you can do anything in the car. You listen to whatever you want. You can literally scream your head off and no one will hear you. You know, your neighbors won't be banging on the walls telling you to shut up. I think, you know, it's that isolation that brings out those feelings in you, maybe.
So you performed that on Saturday Night Live. How much
oh, yeah.
after the release?
Oh my gosh, really soon after. I mean, Saturday Night Live was one of my first performances. I think I released that song and I performed at the Brits in London and SNL. Those were my, like, first two performances in my, like, singer-songwriter career, which is pretty wild looking back.
Ladies and gentlemen, Olivia Rodrigo!
Driver's license last week, just like we always talked about, 'cause you were so excited.
You can hear my full interview with Olivia Rodrigo on the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour. And there's more to come this hour, so stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Sheila Hetty is the kind of novelist that people talk about and have really strong opinions about, too. She's been very influential in the literary world and well beyond. Her book, How Should a Person Be, from 2010, helped launch the trend that's called autofiction, books that twist and blur the boundaries between the novel and the memoir. Writing about Hetty's last book, The New Yorker's critic, Parle Sagel, called out her work's whimsical self-consciousness and its preoccupation with mysticism, questions of faith, and ethics.
To me, Sheila Hetty is one of the most interesting novelists working today. She is ruthlessly contemporary, by which I mean she's not interested in writing a novel as a nostalgic exercise. She's constantly trying to figure out new places fiction can go, new ways that we're using language, new ways that our minds are evolving.
Here's Parle Sagel.
Her newest book is titled Alphabetical Diaries. She draws from 10 years of her diaries that she kept, and she took sentences, questions, little moments from her diaries, and has woven them into a new text that has all the best characteristics of a diary. It feels very intimate, it feels private, it feels charged with all the kinds of questions you can only bring to your diary, and she makes of it a separate kind of novel populated with characters that emerge from her own life. I think even in Hetty's career, which has been marked by so many kinds of formal innovation, it has a freshness and surprise all its own. I think this is your 11th book?
Yeah.
Right? Alphabetical Diaries is your 11th book. And even by your standards, this one to me felt fresh, daring, risky, Can you tell us what you've done?
So it's basically, I took 10 years of my diaries, which I wrote on my computer, and put it all into an Excel spreadsheet, and then alphabetized the sentences by, you know, the first letter of the sentence and so on. And yeah, I mean, I think the last 10 years we're just trying to figure out how should this be read? Like, should it be unbearable, you know, like, or should it be kind of welcoming? Like, how much of it is this sort of scientific experiment of what happens, and how much of it should it be like a novel and kind of pleasurable to read and feel sort of narrative despite the lack of chronology?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we could have you read from it for a little bit, just to give a sense of, as you say, these entries were often in the purpose of figuring something out. So there are these prickly questions that come lapping at us that you have sort of, you know, arranged. But I have something from the T chapter, but we can read anything that you...
Yeah, T chapter is fine. Okay. So this is how the T chapter begins. Terrible day. Texting me pictures and apology. Thank God my youth is ending. That Edie Sedgwick should commit suicide. That face. That feeling I had, that pit of fear that he could not love me, is not a reason to not be with him, but a reason to be with him. That feels right to me, and that's the way I want to be in the world. That gives me hope for things, for everything turning out okay. That hot summer, with squares of light coming through the leaves and sparkling on the ground. That is because I got up at 6 this morning. That is being alive. That is how I felt when I was younger, anyway. That is how I spent my days. That is life's activity. That is the only freedom. That is the secret work no one will ever see. That is what Hungarians do, she said. That is what I am here to do. That is what the culture demands of female writers, to be as low as possible. That is what you can learn from writing this book.
I had to keep myself from laughing. That last line, can I ask you what you learned from writing this book? Or one of the things, some of the things you learned?
Yeah, it's funny. I wasn't sure that I had learned anything. And then a couple months ago, I was writing something and I started to feel really depressed. And I thought, you haven't learned anything from editing this book for 15 years? And then I realized I could let myself write without paying so much attention to chronology and just let my mind sort of skip through time much more nimbly, I guess. And yeah, I think that's what I learned. Like, you don't actually, chronology is not the only thing that keeps a person going from beginning to end. And I think I'd known that before, but I hadn't known it quite this much. And that the way that the mind understands time is not chronological.
Mm-hmm. So without chronology, what are some of the ways that you found yourself thinking about how to get the reader going from beginning to end? What becomes the engine, the sort of momentum in this book?
I think it's more like music. It's more like a rhythm. And I think it's juxtaposition. So yeah, I was really like, oh, if you cut those 6 sentences and then sentence number 1 and sentence number 7 are beside each other, that creates a really interesting friction. So I think looking forward to the surprise of those juxtapositions, maybe. And I don't know, I think like by the end of all my editing, like it had become a world. And so you're sort of in that world, and there's like a texture and there's a color to it and there's a character. So all the things that I guess are in a normal novel. But I didn't know, like sometimes I try different things. So sometimes I put all the years into one document, and other times I tried, okay, maybe you do 2005 as one chapter, all in alphabetical order, 2006 as one chapter, all in alphabetical order, 2007. You know, like there were so many different attempts at, I don't know, what am I trying to even do? There's like this way that I was trying to figure out what is even the interesting in this.
So I want to understand a little bit more about what it felt like to be moving these things around. And, you know, you described it as musical and you described it as the rhythm, but it's a book that reads very well and it has a narrative starts to coalesce, right? So mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about how it started to come together and started to move for you.
Well, I wanted it to. So yeah, so I...
I made it.
I mean,
I made it move.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to like narrow the number of characters you know, so that you would get familiar with people. There were certain like locations that I left out, so that you would feel like the world was circumscribed, you know, enough. References to things that only come up once, I was less likely to keep in than references to things that come up 6 or 7 times, you know. And then there were certain times in the diary where there would be like some scene described at length, and I would opt to have that in the book because you remember as you go through the chapters, oh right, you're in this place. I wanted it to feel like because 10 years is a long time, I wanted it to feel like a smaller world than what 10 years actually spans in some way.
Did you see, I mean, I know we're speaking about this novel as a novel, which we should, but I'm feeling nosy a little bit. I'm wondering if going back and spending that much time in your diaries showed you something that you didn't understand or you understand better about some of the events that you were writing about or thinking about.
I don't know. You think every guy that you're with is like so different from every other one. And when you see it all like taken apart like this, you're just like, oh, I'm just going through the same thing over and over. You know, it's like this category of thinking that actually can very easily be replaced.
It's humbling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of depressing. I mean, I guess the other thing that was weird is just like, yeah, there's like archetypal people in your life. So there's the, It was very easy to make composite characters because there are certain kinds of people you're drawn to. And if that person falls out of your life, here comes another person that you draw into your life that has the same traits, you know? So that was sort of interesting to see, which makes the people in your life feel like a once more essential, like you need this bossy whatever female friend or whatever it is, and also I don't know, more like people playing like actors in a role, or you know, you cast them in a role, maybe they're not actually bossy, you just make them bossy, or you know, feel that they're bossing you. I don't know, it's strange. Yeah,
lately when I've been talking to writers of all kinds, I've just kind of just been asking them the same question. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about the novel now, about you know, having done this experiment. Are there other possibilities of the novel that it's opened up for you? You mentioned chronology, but I'm curious about how it has you thinking about the form.
I don't know. I mean, I've been working on this new book for the last 2 or 3 years that kind of involves these conversations that I've had with this chatbot. And I think working with the diaries, what was nice about it all this time was that it didn't really feel like my voice. Because when you're writing for a diary, it's not like a literary voice. And so you're working with something that's not intended for a book. And there's something fun and refreshing about that. And I think like it's fun to find writing that shouldn't be in a novel and to figure out like, can it do the same things that we want writing in novels to do, which is, you know, move us and tell us something new about the world and about ourselves. Yeah, I'm just really tired of my own voice right now.
Very frequently, your novels are described as formally experimental and daring and avant-garde. And I'm curious if this is a conscious strategy, if this is something that you're drawn to when you're putting together a book, or if it's something, these sort of technical risks and you know, formal challenges you set yourself, if it's something that emerges from the story as you begin telling it.
Yeah, it emerges. I mean, I think that's right. Like, except for this Alphabetical Diaries book, which did start off like with a formal idea, this very strict formal idea that I was trying to follow. But no, with all the other books, no, I always want to write like a straight realist novel. I'm always trying to make something proper, you know, and like the books that I love most, like Crime and Punishment or whatever, you know, Anna Karenina. But it doesn't happen because I think I don't notice the same things that those writers that I love notice. I'm impatient with certain things that they were patient with. And so the books morph according to all these characteristics, you know, of what are you impatient with? What are you actually curious about? What actually looks beautiful to you on the page? What sounds good to your ear? Like all that changes what the book becomes. Yeah, but I think in my head, I always, when I'm starting a new one, I always think this is going to be, this is going to be something that, yeah, something that I've read and loved. And I just want to sort of make something like that.
You once said, and I think this was around the time How Should a Person Be came out, that you were interested in experimenting with the contemporary. And when I think of your work, and I think, you know, I mentioned this a little bit earlier about your novels never feeling nostalgic. It never really feels like you're trying to do Middlemarch again. You know, you're always trying to say, what else can I do with character and scene and dialogue and this portable form and just being in somebody's hands for a while?
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to write Middlemarch again. Don't get me wrong.
This might be a dare. But I'm wondering if the contemporary in that particular way is still alluring to you, is something that still feels like something you are interested in meeting?
Yeah. I mean, you're right here. And that's really rare. This moment is, you know, gone now. So what is this moment? I think it's kind of scary and exciting to be right here. And I guess that's why you're here right now, to document right now or to look around right now. And it's as interesting as any other time. I just feel like this kinship with this feeling like everyone who's alive today, we're all here in this moment together, and in 100 years no one will know what we all know, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of, yeah, you want to be present for it. It seems special to be alive in a time with other people.
That was an amazing answer. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me. That was so fun.
Sheila Hetty's new book is called Alphabetical Diaries, and she spoke to staff writer Parul Segal. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.